Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Donald Vance was a 29-year-old U.S. Navy veteran working in Baghdad when the prison door slammed on him. Blindfolded, shackled, thrown on a concrete slab, and cut off from legal representation by an American system and American guards in an American-run detention center in Iraq for 97 days. Vance was not a candy striper. He worked for a private security firm in a war zone, a rough game in a rough country. He says he blew the whistle on shady gun deals, then got swept up in the crackdown. But his treatment and detention as a single American citizen gives a glimpse of what Iraqis face by the thousands in Iraq's maelstrom. Joining me now from Chicago is Donald Vance. He was working in Baghdad for an Iraqi security firm earlier this year when he was detained by the U.S. military for more than 3 months. He had been passing information to the FBI about possible illegal weapons trading at his company. Donald Vance, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Chicago is Mike Kanovitz. He's a civil rights attorney representing Donald Vance. Attorney Kanovitz, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So we want to see what we can learn from your story, Donald Vance, about circumstances in Iraq today. I wish you'd just give us some background first. How on earth did you end up working for a security contractor in Baghdad?
I think it was just one of those positions I just I fell into. There was a niche. I felt that I could fill it. And I think while I was there, I did an outstanding job for my employers.
This was an Iraqi security company, not an American security company.
That's correct.
What kind of work did the company take on?
Our firm primarily provided security and logistical support to non-government organizations and media firms.
So like aid organizations,
That's correct. Media firms,
news media firms. In other words, you would be what, bodyguards for aid groups and the press?
We provided assets such as that, yes.
Assets such as that. So when they were out on the road or even guarding, I know many of them have practically fortresses themselves in Baghdad now with guards and guard secure perimeters and all the rest. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
So what was your job within that organization?
I was a security supervisor.
Do you go by Don or Donald?
Oh, you can call me Don. Sorry.
Okay. A security supervisor. So were you back at headquarters or out in the field? What were you actually doing?
My duties pretty much kept me at a desk at the office.
Deploying expatriate?
Managing personnel, ensuring payroll, making sure guys are getting paid on time, showing up to work, things of that nature. Right.
Most of the employees were Iraqi or foreigners?
The firm, we employed approximately 600 to 800 Iraqis, and the firm employed myself and two other Americans.
Okay. At a certain point, you became uncomfortable with things you saw going on there. Describe that for us.
Yeah, myself and an associate of mine, we started realizing that there were some things happening around us that really rubbed us the wrong way. We witnessed individuals being bribed, members of the Iraqi government, local tribal leaders. We were essentially paying for our client's safety. Mm-hmm. We were essentially paying tribal leaders to keep our clients safe. So they wouldn't be attacked by insurgent/terrorist groups.
Okay, so you saw bribes, kind of protection money to keep gunmen from coming after your clients. What else?
Illegal weapon trading, manufacturing, purchasing and selling.
Illegal weapons trading is what got you in touch with the FBI. What did you see going on there?
What prompted my getting in touch with the Bureau was it wasn't just one specific issue. It was the overall picture of just sheer corruption and illegal activities that were happening at the company and other companies such as ours that were happening around us.
What was going on? What was going on with guns in particular, Mr. Vance?
They were selling weapons to Iraqi Ministry of Interior, Iraqi officials, Iraqi police units, and other Iraqi government assets.
Now, the Ministry of Interior, that's part of the government, but it's also been described as a pretty rich source of death squads and militias. So what you saw this as an illicit trade, an illegal trade.
Absolutely.
You contacted the FBI where? How?
In October of 2005, I had to come home back to Chicago to attend to some family business. I took that opportunity to contact my local branch office. It was during that time I was put in touch with a field agent here in Chicago, and we set up a system of communication between myself in country and in Baghdad, Iraq.
So they were interested. They wanted to know what you had to say.
They were extremely interested.
And were you reporting back to them regularly at that point?
I'd say almost daily.
And this was in what month of this year?
I reported basically anything that I saw, heard, witnessed from October, maybe early November 2005 to April of 2006.
And that was guns coming in, guns going out, the bribery, and all the rest.
Absolutely.
And at a certain point, you began to feel uncomfortable, maybe even in fear. I'm not sure you tell us, for your life?
Absolutely. I was in fear for my life and the life of my associate, Mr. Hertel.
Why?
The firm, like I said, employed three Americans, myself, Nathan Hertel, and another gentleman. This other gentleman, he was being swept up in everything that was happening around him. He was an unstable individual. And I think the way I like to say it is he went native.
And you were afraid that he or Iraqis working with him would do you harm?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, were they making threats on your life, or what was going on?
The morning of the April 15th, when all of these things sort of went down, absolutely, our lives were threatened.
So you called the U.S. Embassy. You said, "Here I am. I've been talking with the FBI. I've got problems. I'm in trouble." Is that what it was? And what happened then?
Well, prior to the morning of April 15th, I had probably several months before that had been in contact with the embassy and other State Department officials, explaining to them my situation, where my location is, and you know the some of the other ongoings. I had met with U.S. assets, Defense Intelligence Agency representatives, other FBI agents in Baghdad.
So you knew them, they knew you, they knew you were out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you called them on the 15th, April 15th of this year, what happened?
Well, when we called the embassy, we called the Tactical Operations Command. I spoke with several contacts that I had within the State Department. They immediately interpreted the data that they were receiving from myself and Nathan Hertel as, "You guys are getting ready to get kidnapped. Hunker down."
You call, "I'm the whistleblower, I'm in trouble," and they sent a rescue team to pick you up, or what happened?
That's correct. A U.S. military quick reaction force was dispatched to our location. They had a unmanned Predator overhead, and ultimately a U.S. military special forces team extracted us.
They searched the house and grounds. They found two large weapons caches. Do you have any idea how large?
No, myself or Nathan Hertel, we never were told exactly how large the cache was. I do know that the military took two large military trucks to haul it all away. It was a quite large cache.
And by that night, you were in the Green Zone, the American Embassy, that huge fortress there. You were there overnight, and just before dawn, the next day, what happened, Donald Vance?
Just before dawn, we were awoken. Told to get dressed. We did so. We were escorted outside of the embassy. Essentially, we were escorted off U.S. soil and handed over to the U.S. military.
Handcuffed? What?
Absolutely. We were escorted off the embassy grounds. We were met by a U.S. military team with a convoy of Humvees. We were blindfolded and handcuffed, zip-tied, and put into convoy Humvees.
The goggles with the lenses over the duct tape,
yes,
and all the rest, and taken out of the green zone. No protect. You asked for armor or protection there because, of course, it's dangerous driving through Baghdad. You got none.
It's dangerous within the green zone. You should never go anywhere without ballistic armor.
And essentially, on that day began 97 days of detention at Camp Cropper, maximum security U.S. military in Baghdad. Is that right?
That's correct.
We're going to talk about what happened there, but Mike Kanovitz, you're representing Donald Vance. He's talked about suing Donald Rumsfeld over this for a denial of his rights as a U.S. citizen. When you look at the story, and we'll hear more of it about what happened in detention, what do you see here as an American attorney, Mr. Kanovitz?
Well, we actually have filed suit against Donald Rumsfeld. The suit was filed yesterday in federal district court,
okay,
in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the focus of that suit starts after the arrest. It has to do with the system under which detainees are held, the conditions they're subjected to, and essentially the complete lack of ability to challenge in any meaningful way the decision to have detained you.
What are you asserting? Are you asserting that Donald Vance, American citizen, should have had full rights, Miranda rights, and everything else in these circumstances in Iraq, or that some minimum standard was not met?
Well, you know, Miranda, in terms of the warning, is not so much of an issue, but Don Vance asked for the assistance of counsel. He was denied that. Don Vance asked for the ability to present witnesses in his defense. He was denied that. He asked to see the evidence that was supposedly being offered as a basis for holding him. He was denied that. These are things much more basic, far predate any Miranda-type concept, and are just very fundamental to the rule of law and fairly ancient concepts on which our liberties are built.
Mm. Donald Vance, you've got us to April 15th, April 16th this year. You are being trundled across Baghdad for Camp Cropper, maximum security, U.S. military-run detention center in Baghdad. What did you find there? What happened?
The camp is primitive. Once you arrive there, you immediately get this feeling of this is a prison. There's no doubt about it in your mind. This is not a temporary holding facility. This is a long-term holding facility. You immediately get the feeling that you're not going anywhere. There were several Iraqis that were within my building that were made known to me that they were on death row. They were waiting for their executions.
A 9-by-9-foot cell, a concrete slab to sleep on. Describe the cell for us.
That's correct. It's a 9-by-9 cell, steel door, small glass window, which is usually covered on the outside by a piece of fabric as to prevent you from looking outside and mm-hmm. only for your guards to look inside.
Mm-hmm.
A steel trap door, I believe they call it a wicket, to hand you your food and whatever other materials need to be passed through the door.
And what were you told when you arrived about why you were there and how long you would been there, would be there?
Upon our arrival at Camp Cropper, we were told absolutely nothing. We were only handled by our guards only. I was never met by a quote-unquote official, which was explained to me why I am here. There was nothing like that. I was literally still, as I was still blindfolded, I was blindfolded up to the point I was within my cell. At that point, I was my blindfold was taken off. I was strip searched, and I was handed a pair of overalls, a jumpsuit, mm-hmm. and they said, "Put this on." And as I'm doing this, I'm asking for an attorney, and there are only one and only statement was, "Somebody will be here to see you."
Your colleague Nathan Ertel got some documents out here a few days later. His read like this. I guess yours would have been similar. It said, "You have been detained for the following reasons. You work for a business entity that possessed one or more large weapons caches on its premises and may be involved in the possible distribution of these weapons to insurgent/terrorist groups." Did you get a memo like that as well?
Identical.
And then you were off to interrogation. What did they ask? What did you say? What were the circumstances?
My interrogations focused on there was never, I don't think, I never felt that there was a single topic of my interrogations. I was never interrogated by the same individuals. It was always different groups almost all the time asking different questions pertaining to our contacts within the Iraqi government. Who are these people? What was the relationship describing? Some interrogators wanted to know about my previous employers, their corporate structure, things of that nature, how much money was the company receiving, contracts. I mean, it was never a single focus.
And not exactly patty cake. You were shackled hand and feet into a wheelchair every time, head covered, yes. Pushed to a room sort of with padded ceiling and walls. Was it rough? Was it fair, the interrogation, in terms of your treatment? Physically.
The interrogations are not... I really don't know how to describe them. It's a place... I've said before, it's a place I only visit again in my nightmares.
Mike Kanowitz, when it came time for some kind of legal procedure here, what did it look like?
There was very little legal procedure involved. You know, normally, what we expect is someone is going to be apprised of why it is that they are suspected of a crime. And just from the paragraph you read, there was a lot of maze, possibles, and... Above and beyond that, he wasn't suspected of any crime. He was suspected of being employed by a company that may possibly have some criminal involvement. What happened is they proceeded for almost 100 days to hold Don and interrogate him. It was an inquisitorial system that he found himself in. It had very little to do with actual guilt or innocence. The only process that was ever given to him for challenging his detention was something called a board. It wasn't even a hearing. He was not told who his decision makers were. He was not told the basis of this decision. It was essentially just another interrogation by people that he was told would eventually decide if he should be detained or not.
Any legal representation there at all?
Absolutely not. And in fact, the document that you were quoting earlier mm-hmm. says you do not have the right to a lawyer. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Don Vance, at those hearings, as they're described here, the New York Times reported on your case, Michael Moss, we'll hear from him later, at this board that reviewed your case, a woman and two men in Army uniforms, U.S. Army uniforms, but no name tags, no rank designations, no attorney for you. What did you learn? What did you come out of there knowing or not knowing?
I walked away with very little about my situation. I think my board probably lasted somewhere in the time of at least an hour prior to my even stepping foot into my tribunal. I had just left an interrogation.
Mm-hmm. At the end, you asked them, "Does my family know I'm alive?" And the lead guy there, unnamed, rank unknown, responded,
"I don't know."
And he
was the statement.
He didn't know, so you didn't know. Were you eventually allowed to correspond with relatives?
Many weeks later. As I'm sure you have a copy of the documents,
yep.
which do state my rights, I had a right to obtain a personal representative. I would have never even been given the opportunity to obtain a personal representative. We were not allowed to write letters, make phone calls. To the world, we disappeared.
We're going to get some perspective on this in a few minutes from people who have been involved in the legal system in Baghdad. We'll hear from Michael Moss, who's been looking more broadly for the New York Times at justice in Iraq these days. It's not an easy scene, but you hear this story and it makes the problems really vivid. I want to begin to turn to our listeners. Paul is calling from South Portland, Maine. Hi, Paul. You're on the air. What do you hear? What do you think, Paul?
Well, I regret the gentleman's detention. I believe it was indeed handled in a criminal matter. Manner. But that said, I have two thoughts. I believe that it's unethical for anyone to go over to Iraq and participate in any manner in our military/corporate venture in Iraq with its intention of privatizing industry, and rewriting intellectual property laws, et cetera, et cetera.
So even as a private security guard, you're...
Absolutely. It's unethical. The entire venture... I mean, the invasion and occupation was illegal by international standards. Therefore, any attachment to it, even by private citizens, is unethical.
And so, but does that mean that Don Vance signed up for, you know, sort of a rough trade and got a rough time and he deserves it or not? How do you see it?
I don't think he deserves it, no. Any detainee under American you know, under Americans' watch should be treated fairly, and I regret the way he was treated. However, I believe now it's his moral obligation to speak out against the war and the occupation and everything that's attached to it. We went over there with the intention not just about the oil and having influence in the area. It was about getting the American industry into Iraq, privatizing their law, you know, changing their laws. So that
Paul, we've got the perspective, and I want to put it to Donald Vance. Don Vance, Paul says, first of all, you are unethical for being there at all. He's sympathetic, thinks it was wrong the way you were handled, but he says you shouldn't have been there.
I understand how Paul feels. Many people feel that, you know, there's no place for contractors in that place. But I would like to say that contractors fill a role that a lot of people are unwilling to fill. A lot of the military is stretched. There's many tasks that the military cannot perform at this time, and as it right now, the contractors are filling a vital role.
I can say I'm sure there are news organizations there who want and need security, though clearly you're in ambiguous waters right there. I want to bring another voice into this conversation, if I may, from Washington. We're joined by Bruce Ellis Fine. He's a staff judge advocate for the 354th Civil Affairs Brigade, U.S. Army Reserve, served in Baghdad from April 03 to July 04, was assistant to the senior advisor of the Coalition Provisional Authority for Justice in Baghdad. Bruce Ellis Fine, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me. Let me just say that although I am still in the Army Reserves, I'm speaking only for myself, not in any official capacity.
We got it. I expect you've read this story and you've heard more today. You were there. You helped kind of set up this justice system, and we're reading a lot lately about how it's breaking down, not working at all. What do you make of this? Is this just par for the course in a wild war zone like we have in Iraq today, or, you know, is there some fundamental failure here to model the very things we're supposed to be bringing to Iraq?
Well, Tom, I think a distinction needs to be made here between two different detention and criminal systems that exist in Iraq. The one that Mr. Vance experienced is the security internee detention system, whereby the coalition military forces, pursuant to international law, are able to detain people whom they perceive as a threat to themselves or to the occupation. And under international law, there are no due process rights there. That has to be distinguished from the civilian indigenous Iraqi criminal justice system, from which foreign security contractors actually are immune.
Now, do you mean to say by that that you think he was treated just fine? He has no rights to represent?
No, I don't presume to say that at all. I'm just, for the benefit of your listeners, they should know that's not the indigenous Iraqi legal criminal system at work. That's the security internee system.
Right. So technically and officially, two different systems here, though there's a kind of common theme we're reading about lately of what sounds like a pretty rough handling of justice in both. What about the way Don Vance was actually treated here? Where do you see the flaws in it, and why do you think they occur?
Well, he definitely received rough justice, but I think it's important to realize that there's not much. The military has rather little leeway for due process on the battlefield, given the practicalities of the situation. I mean, soldiers are not police. They're not trained to bag and tag evidence, to take witness statements. They've got a lot of detainees because they know that many of them are innocent of wrongdoing, but it's exceedingly difficult to differentiate between really bad seeds and people who haven't really done anything wrong. And that's why international law realizes that in the case of an occupation, the occupier is going to have to be able to take some people even without solid evidence. So, as I said, security contractors are immune from indigenous Iraqi legal process, so if they're not processed by the military, they can operate essentially with impunity. Now, you will have unfortunate cases like Mr. Vance's, which probably could have been handled better, especially since he's an American system, but that's an unfortunate artifact of the nature of war, which is a sledgehammer and not a scalpel.
Don Vance, the suggestion here is, you know, you got yourself in harm's way. You signed up to be a private contractor in a war zone, and you spent 3 months in prison when the company you worked for put these big weapons caches aside. So, you know, deal with it. It was rough business. You were in the middle of it. What did you expect?
What I received is absolutely not what I expected. I expected to arrive at the embassy and to essentially I was wanting to return home. I had revealed everything that I had known. I don't think my interrogators learned any more than what I had already been telling the FBI, that I had already been telling the defense intelligence agents, that I had already been telling the U.S. State Department representatives. It was just unnecessary.
Attorney Kanovitz, you've been quoted as saying treating an American citizen in this fashion would have been unthinkable before 9/11. Bruce Ellis Fine says, hey, it's a war zone. Your client was there. Yeah, it wasn't nice. It was a sledgehammer. But, he, you know, there are no requirements to give him better than this. And there we are.
It's absolutely not true, in my opinion. And I have a question for Mr. Ellis, which is, mm-hmm. is the following. In drawing a distinction between the Iraqi court system and this security internee system, apparently the concept is that under international law, there is no due process rights for someone that our government decides to classify as a security internee. And I think we could debate that back and forth. But what happens in the instance where our government classifies one of our own citizens as a security internee? Is international law here, or the lack of due process under international law, going to trump our Constitution, which is the entire basis of our system in our country, or is what's going on here an abuse of taking an American citizen and trying to deprive them of constitutional rights by placing a label on them?
Bruce Ellis Fine?
Well, that raises issues about the extraterritorial applicability of the Constitution and constitutional rights in a war zone. You know, you don't have the same due process rights, First Amendment rights, et cetera, when you're in the middle of a war zone as you do in some other places. And I don't want to be perceived to be saying that I think that this case was handled wonderfully and perfectly, but I'm saying that the fog of war is very real, and you will have unfortunate cases like Mr. Vance's when American citizens are found on the battlefield. And fortunately, they usually are not found on the battlefield. But I think this would be a far different case, say, if Mr. Vance had been apprehended here in the United States, for example.
We're hearing this hour from Donald Vance. He worked for a private security company in Baghdad, blew the whistle on what looked like illicit weapons trading there, got swept up in the crackdown, spent 97 days in U.S. military custody in Iraq, no legal representation, very little contact with the outside world, rough going. He's not happy about it. His attorney, Mike Kanovitz, is also with us from Chicago, representing Don Vance. They filed suit against former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld here. Bruce Ellis Fine is with us. He served in Baghdad. He's a staff judge advocate in the U.S. Army Reserve, speaking as a private citizen, he says, in this hour. But he was there as legal systems got set up in Iraq after the war. And I want to bring one more voice in here now, a reporter who's been doing a lot of work on the subject of justice and Iraq lately. Michael Moss joins us from New York. He's a correspondent for the New York Times. He wrote the story that brought Donald Vance's story to light this weekend. Michael Moss, thanks a lot for being with us.
Nice to speak with you again, Tom.
So what do you make of this story of Don Vance? We have callers who are saying it's an outrage, others saying, look, he was over there as a private security contractor. What did he expect? What do you make of it? How's it being seen in Iraq itself?
You know, I'm not in Iraq right now, so I can't tell you that, Tom. I'm back in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, I can tell you what interested me about his story, especially, was that it opens a window for us into the American detention system. And you're right, this is sort of a part of a series of stories that we've been looking at the U.S. effort to establish a police force in Iraq and establish a judicial system. And much of that is quite foggy. And in talking to Iraqi civilians who come out of the American detention system, you don't get nearly the vivid details and analysis and impressions that you do from Mr. Vance and his former colleague who were at Camp Cropper. So to me as a reporter, his experience and the documents that they brought back were incredibly valuable as insight into the detention system.
I think you heard Bruce Ellis Fine saying we have two different systems here, one the U.S. military security internee system, the other the Iraqi justice system, which you've reported in great depth on its problems. But are you drawing a parallel here? Is there something, do they share something? I mean, it's two different forces, two different governments.
There are many things they share, although there are some distinctions. I think, as I pointed out in yesterday's story, Mr. Vance was lucky in that he at least got to attend his hearing at Camp Cropper to determine his fate. All other detainees, including the thousands of Iraqis who sort of go through that process, you know, neither get to attend personally or have legal representation there. So in that sense, indeed, there are sort of two processes. But it's still, by and large, sort of the same problem, which is you have soldiers who are untrained as police being asked to do police work, which is basically, you know, on the side decide whether someone should be detained or not, and then you have a very difficult, you know, under the war effort by these American military attorneys in the detention system to figure out who is truly a threat and who is not. And this is, in fact, a larger kind of post 9/11 question, which is how do we set up a system where innocent people can be quickly sorted out from the rest? Because there's a larger problem facing the military, too, which is the longer they hold Iraqis in detention, they say, the higher the risk is of radicalization. And I had a number of American attorneys, military attorneys, say to me that there was sort of a common joke among them, which was, you know, if this guy wasn't radicalized when we threw him in detention, boy, he sure is going to be when we let him out.
I want to hear from our listeners on Don Vance's story. Let me go to John in Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I just heard before that essentially, to all intents and purposes, Mr. Vance was basically kidnapped off of the grounds of the American embassy. Now, I would think that the American embassy is United States property, so if he were on there, then taking them off of that violated his complete constitutional rights. I mean, the fact that I think this whole business was a straw man. I mean, they had to explain on the grounds before they yanked them off of there.
But they didn't have. I mean, they didn't. Bruce Ellis Fine, you hear John's point. You say Don Vance was picked up essentially in a war zone on a battlefield. John says, well, he was picked up in a U.S. embassy. Isn't that different?
Well, I don't know the legal nuance as to whether or not the embassy is considered American property or American soil, so to speak. But all of Iraq is considered a war zone, and we certainly pick up security internees wherever they're found in the war zone.
But they put the handcuffs on them in the U.S. embassy. Mike Kanovich, does that make a difference to you?
It doesn't make a difference because in my belief, as an American citizen being held by his own government, Mr. Vance had the right to fundamental due process all along. But certainly, while he's on an American embassy, he's on American soil. And the argument that he's been slapped with the label of security internee and therefore doesn't have any rights evaporates.
What about to Michael Moss's point that we're in there's this gray zone post 9/11? Where war and police work kind of come up against each other, and it's hard to know which side a particular individual is on. Your client fell on the war side of that and got treated that way.
In my opinion, our Constitution does a perfectly fine job of sorting out the guilty from the innocent, and particularly post 9/11. And particularly in a country where we're trying to establish a democracy, we should be sharing with them the best of what our democracy accomplishes, things like separation of powers, things like due process, things like rule of law, and to not display what is great about our country, I think, is a fatally mistaken move.
Let me go
Could
to...
Could I respond to that?
Is that Bruce?
Tom, that is. It is Bruce.
Yes,
indeed.
Please.
I would like to respond to that because I think that here's where the distinction between the security internee system and the indigenous legal system comes into focus. While it is impractical while you're fighting a war to do conventional, traditional police work, it's not accurate to say that the coalition did not try to share with the Iraqis the great things about democracy, such as separation of powers. In fact, we undertook a great number of initiatives in reforming the Iraqi legal system, including separation of powers. That was one of the most important, actually. The judiciary had been a part of the executive branch.
You undertook that, what, in the process of helping them structure a new judiciary and legal system?
Yes, exactly. The judiciary was removed from the executive branch and set up as its own independent branch. A committee was established to vet judges for past complicity in atrocities and corruption. A commission on public integrity was formed to combat corruption. New prison regulations requiring more humane treatment were instituted. There was instituted for the Iraqi system, not for the security detainee system, a right to legal counsel. There was training for defense attorneys. There was a payment system set up for defense attorneys. Mm. People were given the right not to incriminate themselves.
Let me ask, if I may, to you, Michael Moss, how is all that working out on the ground in Iraq?
You know, I think what we're seeing is that many of these ambitious plans from in the first year have gotten swamped by the realities of Iraq, so that some of the very same problems that were being addressed initially have sort of come back to undermine the system. I mean, these days you hear of judges, you know, facing threats from militants and insurgent groups, pressure from Shiite groups to swing their opinions in cases one way or the other. You hear from defense attorneys who say they're entirely incapable of mounting any sort of effective defense for their Iraqi clients, whether they've been detained by the American forces or by the Iraqi forces. The piece we did on Sunday sort of looked closely at the Central Criminal Court in Iraq, which is being used both by American forces and Iraqi forces to prosecute the larger crimes. And it's a tough go for everybody involved. And you hear from soldiers who are saying, you know, untold numbers of bad guys are getting released and we're recapturing again. You hear from Iraqi civil rights attorneys saying that the system isn't working for them as well. It's an incredibly arduous task trying to make a civil justice system work at a time of war, and yet that's what they're trying to do.
Donald Vance, you were the guy in the cell. I don't want to lose track of you here. I wish you'd take us to the moment or moments when you felt most despairing about your kind of, floating in ambiguity status there, about your circumstances during your imprisonment. When did it hit home to you the hardest just how unrepresented outside of traditional American legal expectations you were?
I think it was my lowest point was, one, my arrival. My second lowest point was when Nathan Ertel, my associate, was released, and I was there by myself to fend for myself. I had no one else to support me. I had what I had was the power of prayer. But I would also like to mention really quickly, from the current question, is I could have easily have been transported via U.S. Marshals back to the United States to answer questions and things like this. But instead, the military realized, one, he's on the embassy. We've got to get him off that embassy. They did that. Two,
what do you mean by that? He's on the embassy. We've got to get him off.
Well, obviously, I'm a U.S. citizen on the embassy. That is just as the same as myself right now. I'm sitting here in Chicago.
They wanted you off, you think, of embassy grounds.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We've got to get this guy off the embassy. Mm-hmm. They did that. Two, we cannot allow him to return to the United States where he has full due process. So hence me being put into Camp Cropper.
And there you eventually got out phone calls, letters to your fiance, girlfriend in Chicago. She was raising a ruckus there. Did you
absolutely
when you raised complaints within the prison? I mean, what did you say? You can't treat me this way. I'm a U.S. citizen. What response did you get?
I'd like to describe myself as a few times I was pretty adverse to the camp command and staff. I wrote many. Letters to the camp staff. Most, I would say 99% of them went unanswered. The one in few times in which I did, as you'd want to say, raised hell, the camp commandant, the camp warden, came down and took me out of my cell, and I was making him aware of some of the things that were happening to me.
And he
apologized to me.
Oh.
He says, "I'm sorry this is happening. I didn't know these sorts of things were happening. I'm going to do everything in my power to ensure these aren't happening." But I never noticed any change again.
Let me go to Don in Middletown, Maryland. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? The comments that I have to make are that the defendant there, he was lucky to be alive, and he put himself in a situation voluntarily. He went there for a profitable business to make money, and that he is lucky that the U.S. soldiers were there to extract him from a situation in which he got himself into.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry that he felt he got mistreated, and maybe he could have been treated better in that situation, and I'm sorry that happened to him, because I certainly wouldn't want that to happen to me. But he is lucky to be alive, and he should be thankful to the U.S. soldiers that did extract him from that situation. And and I think this is a waste of our time to be suing Donald Rumsfeld and tying up the legal system with something of this nature.
We hear it. Donald Vance, what do you say to that?
Absolutely. I think the military, that the men and women that are currently in Iraq, they are the strongest and the greatest army this nation's ever put together. They are the greatest bunch of guys. And the actual rescue force, the special forces team and the QRF force team that arrived, I did thank them. When I arrived at the embassy, we were met by individuals from the hostage working group, and I thank them and all their efforts in the operations command that were watching my situation happen real time. I thank everybody that got me out of there.
Let me get one more call from Fred in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is regarding the military interrogators that have been reported having no name tag and no rank on them.
And this, not even the interrogators, but this is at the sort of more formal review hearing. What response do you have to that, Fred?
I thought that any military interrogation, any military contact with anybody, they should be in full uniform, i.e. name tags, insignia of their rank and so on. The story was that as he was getting interrogated, these U.S. military people had no identification on them.
Yeah, our time is short. Let us pick that up. Bruce Ellis Fine, is that standard operating procedure? Is that all right? Why no identification, rank, anything?
That's really, I wasn't involved in the interrogations and in the security internee system, so unfortunately that's something I just don't know about.
Michael Moss, is this par for the course these days? It seems like an awfully anonymous face of power.
No, that's procedure, and I think the perception on the military part is that there's too much risk involved. They do not want Al Qaeda members knowing their names or somebody who might be a threat to them personally. So that is actually the procedure.
Do you sense, Michael Moss, a floor sort of being built underneath the legal systems in Iraq, the Iraqi, the American, at some point, or are we just descending further into a kind of open system, and I don't mean that positively here, as things burn out of control?
Boy, I wish I could give you a sense of that, and I wish I had a sense of where the whole war was going, and I'm sorry I don't. I know that the people who are working on the justice system in Iraq, Americans included, some of them are optimistic, others are pessimistic. Again, sort of the notion of sort of creating and imposing a civil justice system at a time of war is incredibly daunting. And I myself came away fairly pessimistic about its potential for success at this time anyway.
Mike Kanovitz, Donald Vance is your client. What do you see as the moral of this story?
I see a problem where U.S. officials are able to slap a label on a citizen and thereby deprive them of his rights. And while it's true that this took place in a foreign country, and while it's true that Don Vance made a voluntary decision to go to a foreign country. Our citizens make decisions like that, and they make patriotic decisions like that every day. Don Vance went to help build a country that would become an ally and a friend to the United States. Any time that we lose the underpinnings of due process that allows an individual to challenge their detention, that's a big problem.
Don Vance, ever going back to Baghdad?
You never know.
Oh, boy. Donald Vance, 97 days in American detention in Baghdad. He's out. His attorney, Mike Kanovitz, they've been with us from Chicago. Bruce Ellis Fine in Washington, we thank you for being with us today. Thanks a lot for being here. And Michael Moss, the New York Times correspondent who's reported on it all. Michael, thank you for your reporting and your time. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.